Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I saw a film today, oh boy.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the picture?
Come and see me in the movie.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the second season of the Beatles Films podcast. They said it would never happen. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and we're back each week discussing a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This season, we're kicking things off with 2009's Nowhere Boy, which sees Aaron Taylor-Johnson star as a rebellious teenage John Lennon, confronting the complicated circumstances of his upbringing by reconnecting with his estranged mother, while continuing to live under the guardianship of his disapproving Aunt Mimi. At the same time, Lennon first develops his passion for music, taking up the guitar and starting his first band to begin a journey that ends here with him about to leave for Hamburg. Which technically makes this film a direct prequel to previous Beatles Films podcast movie Backbeat, but only if you subscribe to the idea that all film biopics are actual installments in the shared cinematic universe of life. Ed, first question for you.
Is that true? yes, it is.
That's exactly how all biopics work. So, obviously, a central theme of the film is that John's relationship with his mother is a driving force for his creativity, but also, I guess, for his feelings of anger, feelings of resentment and jealousy that we know come into fruition more as he gets older. Do we think that this is the film presenting that as a sort of faux Freudian idea? Do we think that's true? What are your thoughts there?
I'm sure there's a broad truth to it, but like everything else, and, you know, the entire reason people like us do podcasts about things is it probably bears further discussion. I think one of the things about John Lennon in particular is so much motive is sort of attributed to him by people who are like us, who are written by, you know, and most reviewers and biographers who are really only making educated guesses. It's fairly obvious that the death of his mother had an effect on him, and it had an effect on his art. That became more obvious in his immediately post-Beatles solo work. So, you know, there's a hidden message in the song "My Mummy's Dead," I found, which I don't know if you spotted. he was not all that keen on the fact that his mother had died, and he'd obviously made songs like "Julia" in 1968, and I think getting together with Yoko Ono. And sort of getting himself into therapy and thinking about himself in a slightly more self-indulgent, arguably even solipsistic kind of a way, made him think about these things more. And that naturally came out in his art. So yes, I think it is fair to say that these formative experiences had an effect on his art, as I think they would for anyone's, really.
I think that there's you can almost trace a lot of what we know about John Lennon back to the story that this film tells. So, you know, what you're saying there about John Lennon, his art, the songs that he would write later on in his career that directly addressed his mother. But also, this film tells the story that she was one who introduced him to rock and roll in the first place. Mm. And that leads to all of the things that set him along that path. The film almost presents this view that his mum is almost responsible for all of those aspects of his career.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's literal art, the later songs where he's addressing that and his the emotions that he's sort of pouring into his music there, and he's addressing that in his lyrics, but right back to the start of the Beatles' career, which is, you know, where he first discovered that love for rock and roll music.
Yeah, I think so. There's things like this that are alluded to in the anthology and the Beatles story in general. Paul certainly mentions in the anthology of having fond memories of Julia Lennon, Julia Stanley. I'm not sure what her name was at the time, but
Julia,
that'll do. having fond memories about her being fun and playing the ukulele. He says that thing in, you know, in the anthology about, you know, even now when I meet grown-ups who play the ukulele, I love them, which is nice that he, as a man in his 50s or 60s, uses the term grown-ups. But, you know, that's by the by. But yeah, certainly she seems to have encouraged that in him. And it's not just this film that demonstrates that. It's sort of fairly well documented that she sort of showed him banjo chords to begin with, which is sort of what, when he met Paul, he was still kind of playing banjo chords, but on a guitar. So yeah, she certainly seems to have been an influence on him that way. But I don't know. I mean, so one of the things that the film is doing is, it would obviously not be right to say that John is a secondary character in it, but I do think that the relationship and the tension between Julia and her sister Mimi is one of the main things that's going on in the film. And I suppose the interesting thing to consider, if the film is going to frame it in those terms, is if he had just been raised by Mimi, he was already sort of, he was a rebellious kid, but whether that creative spirit would have come out in quite the same way if he'd just been raised by Mimi and not had that sort of brief reconciliation with his mother before she died.
It's interesting as well, because I remember, you know, the film is very highly regarded, I think, by critics. I think it's currently sits at 80% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I remember when I first saw it, when it first came out, I definitely felt the same way in the sense that, you know, I thought this is, not that it bowled me over, but like this is a film that is worthy of a lot of praise for many reasons. When I was watching it this time around to get ready for this recording, about halfway through, I was just struck by this idea of, this is one of those biopics where not much happens. There's not much to it. You know, like sometimes you have those films where it's choosing to tell a chapter of a famous person's life, but actually without a clear story to tell, like a nice way of bookending. Like, you know, this is the story you're trying to tell, and this is the conclusion of that story. Because so often with biopics, there isn't a conclusion to the story, and actually that person goes on to do other things, which is the case here. And actually it was about halfway through this that I realised that that comes with the relationship between Mimi and Julia. And actually the conclusion comes in that scene right at the end of the film where you see them on deck chairs in her garden, having made peace with each other. And that's a really nice way. Even though it's a story about John Lennon, it's through them that we get the sort of the traditional narrative arc of a challenge and a resolution.
Yeah.
Which I just thought was quite interesting. Because, you know, that's not how you do expect that story to tell. And it's quite nice that he was the person that just sort of almost made that happen in a way. He has this wonderful speech at the end where he says, there's no point in hating someone you love, or something, which when he talks to Mimi at the gravestone.
Yeah.
He has his poignant moment. It sort of sets his John Lennon up in this film as someone who's almost wise beyond his years a little bit because of what he's had to go through up to that point.
Yeah, So, I mean, certainly the film is showing a sort of 16, 17-year-old John, who is a remarkable young man. You could very easily make a film about a teenage John Lennon that showed him as a sort of a bit of a dosser and a rebel, you know, without a cause, quite literally, who actually wasn't really going anywhere. And, you know, it turned out he was good at guitar and good at singing, and that kind of got him out of it. But I like the fact that there's a scene early on. I think it's like the headmaster has caught him with porn or something like that.
Yeah.
And he said, "Have you got anything to say for yourself?" And he says, "I don't suppose there's any chance of getting it back, is there, sir?"
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of thing, it's wittier than general teenage surliness.
Yeah.
You know, he's got a sense of humor. He's a witty guy to start off with. I like the fact that it's kind of making that clear, you know.
I think the one thing I will say about that moment is that, as always, part of my preparation and research, my thorough research for these recordings, is that I go immediately to IMDb trivia page.
Yeah.
Where we have lots of unsourced facts that apply to these films.
Yeah.
But one thing I'll say about the film is that under the goof section of IMDb, it kind of tickled me a little bit that someone has written this, obviously, submitted this as part of the goofs page for this film. In the headmaster's office scene, the boys have apparently been reading Parade magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Before 1960, Parade was actually titled Blighty Parade, which I liked because I felt like someone's watching that film, saw that error and thought, you know what, I know my porn. This needs to be corrected. Like, if there's one part of this film that I feel like I can be an authority on, it's the porn part of it. Right, so I'm going to correct that immediately in IMDb.
Yeah, yeah, anonymously.
Yes, exactly.
Just in case.
But the other part of that bit, though, was you're right in that the way John has these nice sort of pithy, cocky moments in the film.
Yeah.
There are a few moments in the film where what he says feels like there's an applied sense of wisdom or like almost like otherworldliness that's given to the character.
Yeah.
So in that scene, I think the headmaster says something to him about he's going nowhere. And he says something like, "Is nowhere full of geniuses? Because if so, that's where I belong." Or so. And that feels like that's quite a more complex thought that someone might just have in the moment.
Yeah. So I suppose what it's doing is that inevitable thing of showing a young version of a person who is very, very familiar to all of us and equating the young version with the person that we know he turned out to be.
Yeah.
Because there is a bit of fan service in the idea of showing flashes of the person who we know he would turn out to be.
Mm.
And actually, I was thinking earlier when, before we started recording, you were talking to me about the poster of this, which is sort of him, Aaron Taylor Johnson, as young John, lying down, looking up at a cloud,
mm-hmm.
which is a parody of, it's not the Imagine cover that we know, but maybe it was the sort of alternative version, or maybe it was on the back of the back sleeve or something like that. But there is a picture of John from those Imagine photo sessions where he's sort of looking up at the cloud. And so when it does that, it is deliberately showing you iconography that you recognize from later Lennon and applying it to earlier Lennon.
Yes.
And it's thus implying that there is a connection. Well, obviously there's a connection between the person he was and the person he became, but almost an equation between the two things.
Yeah. Makes sense.
And there are a few things it does. It does it, however, in, I think, almost completely without resorting to those, we've talked about them in a few episodes now, those little things where someone says a lyric from a song that they won't write for another 7 years.
Yes,
or something like that.
I
don't think it's got any of that in it.
It doesn't, no, but yeah. I do know we certainly had to pick that up before. Backbeat was very guilty of that.
Yes.
And to that point, can I make my very clever observation about the very first scene in the film?
I look forward to it.
Thank you. So the film opens with the Hard Day's Night chord ringing out, so not obviously going into the rest of the song, but it's just the chord, the opening chord, and then left to ring out. And then we see John running with the sort of distant sounds of what sound like Beatlemania screams. and then it cuts to him waking up. So it's, you know, sort of almost like a dream sequence.
Yeah.
And I wrote a review of this film when it first came out in 2009. When I watched it this time around, I don't think I really fully understand what I was trying to say, but I was able to rediscover the review that I wrote at that time. And past me from 13 years ago was much cleverer than present me now, because I made a very good point in that review, which is that the Hard Day's Night chord ringing out at the start emphasizes that this is an intro. This is possibly one of the most famous intros to any pop song written. And actually, that sets the theme of the substance of the film itself, which is this is the intro to John Lennon's life. So just got sort of a neat tie in there to the Beatles music without actually having to go through any of that pesky copywriting.
Yeah,
but yeah, just an interesting sort of artistic choice to do that, and I think a sort of a neat way into find a parallel between the music and what story this film is about to tell at that point.
Yeah, it's a nice way of doing it. Yeah, you're right. You were clever in 2009, weren't you?
I don't know what happened.
No, exactly. I wish I'd done a podcast with that guy.
So do I. It's also worth pointing out, actually, that I think there was a lot of expectation. It'd be worth hearing your thoughts on this. There's a lot of expectation that this film was Sam, who was then Sam Taylor Woods, the director of this film, her directorial debut.
Mm-hmm.
But she was known at the time as being an artist, a photography artist, that was quite, I guess, liked to sort of push the envelope in her work and was quite bold and adventurous,
right,
with her art. And I think that there was an expectation at the time this film was released that this might be quite an adventurous take on a Lennon biopic. But actually what we get is something that's a little bit more by the numbers. Which is absolutely fine, obviously. I feel like it's interesting when those sort of flourishes come through in the film. I think that, you know, the Hard Day's Night chord at the start is an instance of that.
Yeah.
I think I think probably one of the more obvious moments in the film is that nice sort of time-lapse montage of Lennon learning the banjo and the guitar.
Yeah.
In real time whilst everyone else is sort of speeding around him and stuff.
Mm.
That's in a sort of a nice sort of directorial flourish. But I think that some of the criticism that was aimed at the film at the time was that people were expecting something a little bit more out there and perhaps a little bit more in keeping with Lennon's later artistic innovations.
Yeah, oh, that's interesting. Well, I mean, at the time I was aware of Sam Taylor Wood.
Mm.
So I was aware that she was a photographer and an artist. Was she sort of part of that whole scene of sort of Tracy Emin and Damien Hirst and people like that? I don't. Maybe I'm conflating scenes or whatever. But
I want to say yes, just because those are names I recognise from the art world.
Right. Okay.
I can't be 100% certain that they were part of the same. They would say that they were part of the same scene.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I could have just made up names, and you would have had to pretend.
No. I knew,
oh yes, I'm familiar with them.
Yes. Can you imagine? Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. So I wasn't aware that people were. Maybe I was at the time, but certainly watching it now, I wasn't aware that people were kind of expecting anything very different.
But I think the interesting thing is that this is a very much a by the numbers biopic, like
reasonably,
and I guess, you know, that's it. But that's obviously perfectly serviceable, right? Like that's, you know, any expectation placed on the film is not a fault of the film itself. Like what the what we get is actually a really well told and well presented version of events.
Yeah, definitely. And I wonder whether, so I suppose maybe there are a couple of things that influenced her decision to approach it in this way. One being, this is my first film.
Mm-hmm.
It's a British film that has got funded, which
it's
certainly back then, still the case now, but certainly back then, I think it got some National Lottery funding or got some funding from Film 4, maybe a bit of both.
It was Film 4, yeah.
Getting a British film funded is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And it is probably, so I don't think it's a film that, I would not describe it as a film that plays safe, but I will use that phrase to describe, you know, if she had sort of wackier artistic urges that she would naturally have gone down, I can completely understand her thinking, this is my, I want to get into filmmaking. This is the first film I've directed and I've got funding for it. Let's do it properly.
Yes.
You know? Let's make a kind of standard film. And then I can build on it from there. And the second thing is that she was probably pretty acutely aware of the fact that people tend to go off the deep end a bit when you muck around with the Beatles story. There's a subset of that audience who will think of the whole thing as sacrosanct. And if you're the person who's been tasked with making what is probably going to be the only biopic about John Lennon at this age, that specifically focuses on this year or two of his life, that if you go all like crazy and, you know, there's like time lapse pictures of a snail on a leaf for 5 minutes or whatever, that they're just going to have a go at you for it. That's a specific example from...
We know the art world so well.
We do, don't we? We do. But no, I don't know why I said snail on a leaf, because that happens in one of the Terrence Malick films.
Right.
So it's like...
Everyone, I know the one you mean.
Everyone picks him up for it.
Yeah.
Thin Red Line, maybe, or something?
No, is it Thin Red Line? No, I was thinking of Tree of Life.
Tree of Life.
I was thinking of that. I don't know if it is that one. I can't think of the specific snail you're talking about.
The specific snail. Yeah.
I'm sure I'd recognise him if I saw him.
Sure.
But yeah, it's interesting you said it, because, you know, we obviously covered in a previous episode Across the Universe, which is, you could argue, the other approach that could have been taken, you know, with the Beatles story, in that, you know, you have someone who comes from an artistic background and is applying like a wild take on the subject matter.
Yeah.
You know, obviously there's distinctly different directorial voices, but you could argue that this more sort of reverential approach to the biopic that ended up serving audiences better.
Yeah.
Certainly one that I think has been better received.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
But yeah, interesting all the same. And I guess moving from Sam Taylor Wood makes sense at this juncture to just talk about Aaron Taylor Johnson generally and his performance. How do you rate him as a John Lennon here? We've obviously discussed in the past other John Lennons, most notably probably Ian Hart.
Yeah.
How does he rank on your Lennonometer?
Are we ranking Lennons?
Okay. We should. We absolutely should.
We should do. Yeah.
Let's go through them. Who's on there? So we've got Ian Hart, obviously.
Yeah.
We have Robert Carlyle from Yesterday.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
We have from Two of Us, Jared Harris.
Yes.
And from Chapter 27,
Mark Lindsay Chapman.
Yeah. Is that all of the ones that we've covered so far?
Yes, I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, I'm going to say yes. Okay, yeah. We may have forgotten one. But also, and then we're adding Aaron Taylor Johnson to that. So,
I suppose also there's John Lennon, who played John Lennon in the film Help, which we covered last season.
I mean, I didn't want to go down that route, but sure. Where does John Lennon rank on the Lennonometer of people who have played John Lennon?
Don't write him, to be honest. Overrated.
I've seen much better John Lennons.
Let's leave him out.
Yeah, I think that's safe.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because it's you know, Aaron Taylor Johnson had a lot of plaudits at the time of this film. He was award nominated, I think, I think it may have even been BAFTA nominated.
Yeah.
A performance in this film. So let's go through him. Who makes a good Lennon of the ones we just listed?
Ian Hart is the obvious one,
yeah,
because he's done it so many times. It's like Michael Sheen playing Tony Blair,
so many times.
Yeah. So, well, three times, which I think is the same number of times that Sheen has blared, and Ian Hart is great. As I said in the Backbeat episode, I think there is a sort of one note element to his performance where he plays the sarcasm very well, but perhaps the softer side a bit less. But to be fair, maybe those roles didn't give him that chance quite so well.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Lindsay Chapman In terms of standing around giving an autograph and then saying, "Is that all you want?" Can't fault him. difficult to see how anyone could have done it better.
Ian Hart wishes he had that kind of material to work with.
Yeah. Hart cries himself to sleep every night watching that performance. You know.
Jared Harris,
accent not flawless, but I think he got elements of his character very well.
Mm-hmm.
Who else was there?
Robert Carlyle, obviously as an alternate Lennon.
Well, I mean, Robert Carlyle has to get extra credit for the fact that, as evidenced by our yesterday episode, I didn't actually realise it was him until you told me.
Well, I mean, that's only him getting extra credit if you thought it was the actual real life John Lennon.
Yes, no, true. Yeah.
Re-rating his acting capabilities here. If you believe John Lennon was actually in that film,
yeah,
then he definitely deserves that credit.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I think, like, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, he does a fantastic job in this.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about, like I say, he plays John as a kid with a lot of wits. The really interesting thing about the way he plays John is that he plays him as a sort of genuine tough guy. And that really, really interested me. You hear a lot of sort of Paul describing how he sort of alludes to the fact that actually before he met John at the Wilton Village fete, he'd seen him around a little bit and he just thought he was a teddy boy and he was a tough guy and he sort of kept up. He could tell that, like, maybe this was a guy who'd kind of want to keep out of his way a little bit. And people do talk about John, like, you know, getting into fights quite a lot and being physically intimidating, you know, and you can imagine him definitely being like the leader of his gang or peer group.
Yeah.
And not just because he had a cutting wit, but also because physically he was quite imposing in a way. Aaron Taylor-Johnson does that really, really well. There are scenes when he's just sort of like wearing a vest and he's sort of pretty well built and he looks kind of imposing and he's sort of just wearing a vest and putting braces on over the top of it, like he's sort of, you know, that scene in The Godfather where they're all hanging around wearing vests, like James Caan, and like, you know, with braces over the top of it and like sort of smoking cigarettes and stuff like that, you know. And I think it's, I'm not going to say it's a side we haven't seen, but because it's well documented, the kind of guy John was at that time. But I think you contrast that with the way Ian Hart plays him in, so Backbeat in particular, where there are scenes where he's getting into fights and you kind of get the impression from Ian Hart's performance that John was the kind of guy who was very mouthy and would sound off a lot and end up in fights and generally lose them. Or, you know, just not quite be able to back up the mouth.
Yeah.
Aaron Taylor-Johnson just seems to be a kind of tougher version of him.
Tougher version, but also I think the interesting thing for me there is that he does a really good job of portraying that tough guy-ness at the age that Lennon is in this film, which is, I think, 15.
Yeah.
Is it 15? No, it's 17, isn't it?
So 17 is the birthday he has in the film.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, 17. Yes, 16 and 17. Yeah, that's right. And it's actually when he meets Paul that Paul says he's 15, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So he's 16, 17 in this film. Because I get the impression throughout the film that this tough guy persona that he has is kind of him acting up. Like, he's acting the tough guy.
Yeah.
I get the sense from that film that we see John Lennon acting the tough guy as opposed to him being a tough guy.
Okay, yeah.
And I think that one of the ways that that film delivers that nuance is by us also seeing him still being young enough to be a boy in a lot of ways. Yeah. You know, he's still very, very sensitive. He's sensitive to the sort of complex emotions he feels towards his mother, but also things like, one of the scenes that really struck me actually was when Mimi sells his guitar.
Yeah,
and he swears at her, and like he really like acts out in quite a sort of tantrum style rage.
Yes,
and it makes Mimi sort of sit up and take notice of it, because she's like, she didn't realize that it would invoke that kind of reaction from him.
Yeah,
but yeah, you're balance. You know, when you balance the two, like you get this, I guess, dichotomy of any kind of adolescent growing up between transitioning from a sort of a young boy under his parents' wing to becoming his own sort of fully fledged young adult. And sometimes it's play acting a little bit. You know, that's where his cockiness comes from. Sometimes it's not necessarily him being a tough guy and knowing he can win every fight. It's him pretending to be one so he can look like one.
Yeah, true. And also, how accurate it is in terms of his circle of friends, but certainly the friends he has chosen, who he forms the Quarrymen with, like friends like Pete Shotton, they're all people he can dominate.
Yeah.
You know, like, so he's one of the kids, like, you'll remember kids like that from school who would sort of choose a circle of friends who were all people they could, where they knew they could be in charge.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And actually, like, you know, there were probably kids in school that they themselves were a bit scared of. But like, I'm in charge of
this little, group. Yeah. So we're on board with Aaron Taylor-Johnson as Lennon in this. Mm-hmm. Arguably, although we haven't settled on this yet, he might even top the Lennonometer.
Yeah.
But the performances in this film across the board are amazing, right?
Yeah.
All of them are incredible.
Yeah.
We can go on to each of them in turn. Maybe we should cover off some of them quickly, quick thoughts. Anne-Marie Duff as Julia, his mum, I think has some incredible scenes.
Yeah. Here.
There were some moments where as the flighty, flirtatious mother, that's one element of her character, but it's the moments when Lennon deliberately cuts her down. And you see, like, some sort of...
She kind of deflates.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. It's really, really well played. Mm. And in particular, that moment where... we can talk about Kristin Scott Thomas as Mimi next, but that moment where they meet in the cafe towards the end of the film and she says to Julia, I do love you, you know. And there's the reaction is just, like, basically lip-wobbling. You know, you can really see her sort of trying to sort of maintain a composure and stuff, but the impact of what that means to her hearing that is really important. She plays that incredibly well.
Yeah, I think so. I think certainly it's a very difficult role to play because on the surface of it, it's, if this is a character you're tasked with playing, you can look at it and think, oh, this is like a good time girl.
Yeah.
Fine. Easy, you know, and just sort of play it on that level. I mean, she does that very easily, but the other layers she brings to it are really remarkable. The thing that I'm never sure about is it is implied in this that she has something like bipolar disorder,
yeah,
or something along those lines, because it's sort of I think in the sort of big argument at the end, where Mimi says, you know, she liked company. You know what that means, don't you? And I think, or maybe it's in the argument with John outside the house just before that. I forget, but it's where she says, I get ill, John. You know that, you know, like, it's words to that effect. I forget, and certainly her husband seems to be. A tolerant of the fact that she has perhaps they're not quite manic episodes, but certainly periods when she is up and she is, you know, dancing and she's everyone's friend and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you don't quite see the down parts, but you get the impression that in the bits that are described to you, like when the scene when Freddie Lennon kidnapped John and took him to Blackpool, that is sort of semi-depicted near the end, that is a point when she was in a down period, you know, and that is all hinted at.
And even the when she's up, I feel like she plays that with a level of franticness.
Yeah.
That implies that she's forcing herself to keep going. Like she's forcing herself to keep spirits up, because she doesn't want to let the energy levels down, because she doesn't know what will happen then, right? It's almost like she's sort of there's like an impulsiveness to making sure that everyone is having a good time so that she can have a good time.
Yeah,
that you just feel her in those scenes, sort of willing the celebrations to happen so that she doesn't have to deal with the alternative.
Yeah, and I think there's also a part of the way she plays it that makes you sympathize with Mimi a bit.
Yeah.
Because she, Julie, if you look at it from Mimi's point of view, Julie has sort of done none of the hard work of raising this boy. And now he's a teenager and he has a rebellious instinct. He wants to go and hang out with this mother who's a bit more like a fun older sister. And you know, and she just gets all the fun stuff, the parties and the drinking and the rock and roll and stuff like that. And,
yeah, that's
and
a really good point.
And has had to put, you know. And I think the way that Anne-Marie Duff plays her, it does make you slightly unsympathetic to her because of that. You know, you are thinking, because there is also a big part of you that is thinking, you've just breezed back into this boy's life. And you're screwing him up, as you have done, you know, already more than once during his life.
Yeah,
you can kind of see that she's really, really enjoying the fact that she has this connection with her son again. But actually, she's not really thinking about the emotional toll that this might be taking on him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And talking about Mimi, Kristen Scott Thomas.
Yeah, I think. I was thinking about this when watching it, and I sort of came to the conclusion that I think probably the best ever casting of any character in any Beatles film and performance to go along with it is Kristen Scott Thomas's Aunt Mimi. She is unbelievably good. She is so brilliant.
Yeah.
There is...
We need to start a Mimiometer.
We do. There's I really feel like, because Aunt Mimi, in terms of a character in the Beatles story and what we know of her, what do you think of when you think of her? She was quite stern, and she was quite posh, and maybe had or wanted to appear posher than she was. That kind of thing. Even that second one is probably an interpretation you would really only get from doing a bit more digging and background reading than most people would bother with. But generally speaking, what you think of when you think of Aunt Mimi is like John Lennon was raised by an aunt who was quite strict. That's me. And you could be forgiven as Kristen Scott Thomas for just doing that, just being a strict aunt who plays against, you know, the conflict in this film is that all of a sudden this much more flighty mother has come along. They're back in each other's life, and that's the conflict. Strict Mimi against fun Julia, you know, go. And what Kristen Scott Thomas does is there is so much sort of caring and affection for John just beneath the surface of her sort of propriety, you know. And and even her accent, which is so perfect, is just... There's Scouse in it, but it's also a Scouse that she is obviously trying to hide a little bit.
That's amazing, yeah.
You know, and that is to attempt and achieve that is really, really remarkable, I think.
I think, any kind of, you know, those roles kind of pop up, don't they, every now and then, where you have someone who is always trying to maintain composure and contain this maintain this outlook of being like prim and proper,
yeah,
whilst hiding sort of a sense of vulnerability underneath. But yeah, you're right, I mean that comes through in that she's incredible in this.
And think about that scene when they go to the music shop to buy the guitar,
and
the guitar is something that she's sort of discouraged in him, or you know, she is sort of seen to have discouraged. And, you know, she, in real life, apparently, you know, said the famous line, guitar's all right for a hobby, John, but it's not going to earn you any money. That's, you know, that's always harked back to. In this film, it's Mimi who buys John his first guitar. They go to the guitar shop and at this point, they kind of seem at loggerheads with each other. But then they sort of bond in the face of this common enemy, which is this guy... He was just sort of doing his job, selling him a guitar. And they, you see that they actually share a nice little sense of humor. You know, it doesn't sound like a very good deal, does it, John? No, it certainly doesn't, Mimi. You know, they're riffing off each other in a way that you can tell the really nice thing about her is you can tell that she finds him really funny.
Mm.
She is actually really delighted by the fact that he is witty and slightly cheeky. She likes that about him. It's not that she wants to smooth off all his harder edges.
Yeah.
She actually kind of likes that, and she likes the sort of creative side of him as well. And she is just trying to make sure that he doesn't go off the rails completely. Yes.
Yeah.
Because in fairness to her, there was definitely a danger that that would have happened.
I mean, to be in fairness to her, it did happen several times over, you know.
Eventually. True. Yeah.
And one final performance to touch on, Thomas Brody Sangster as Paul.
Yeah.
How do we rate him on the Paulometer, the McCartneyometer?
The
McCometer.
who are we rate? No, you know what? I'm not going through all the Pauls.
No.
He's very strange casting. And I tell you why. So the main thing is there aren't a lot of films in which an actor plays Paul.
Mm.
Right. So it does happen. They don't other than Two of Us, the only film I can think of in which somebody plays Paul McCartney as a lead role. So in Backbeat, he's in it, but he's nothing like a lead role.
Yeah, agreed.
He, George and Pete are kind of like side characters, really. So nobody really thinks, that guy played Paul McCartney really well. You don't get a lot of that. But what does always happen, because he tends to be a bit of a side character, they tend to cast people who look like him, who at least have that kind of slightly doe-eyed thing going on. And Thomas Brody Sangster does not look like Paul McCartney at all. And
he also looks considerably younger than Taylor Johnson. Like, I realise, they are probably age-appropriate. Well, I guess they're age-appropriate casting. The age gap between the two seems bigger than it is in real life.
Yes, it does. And that actually contributes to a sense that I don't really get the sense of their bond being formed particularly. There's a scene at the end where they hug. I think it's when they are seen to be bonding over the fact that their mothers are both recently dead.
Hmm.
And I didn't feel like it had earned that scene particularly. Because other than them playing guitar together, I didn't really get the sense that they were kindred spirits.
I do know what you mean. And I feel like there are some nice moments in the film where you get the impression that Lennon is feeling him out a little bit. Like, he's trying to get a sense of him as a character. And when Paul says that his mum had died here before, that sort of takes John back and sort of sees him in a new light.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. There's also a really nice moment in that exact same scene as well where Lennon asks him, he doesn't seem like the sort to get into rock and roll. And he replies that it's just about music. It's all music, simple. Which I just thought was a really nice, way to summarise Paul generally. Because I think, what we know of him now, in the sense that he's had such an eclectic output in his career, that actually that rings true. Like, his roots may have been in rock and roll music, but actually it's always just about the music, regardless of where it comes from. And that was, I thought that was a nice way of sort of giving a nice, neat summary of his character and how it contrasts to John, which is much more about the emotion that he builds and how he sort of puts that out into an output through music.
Right, okay, yeah. How he expresses it.
How he expresses it.
I think because they're doing a similar thing there with sort of harking forward to the person we know he will be.
Yes.
Because actually, I'm sure Paul would not have expressed it in that way at that time, but certainly it is true that he had already been exposed to influences of like his dad's, jazz records and classical and all that kind of stuff in a way that John had, was sort of less interested in music in that way. It was really just rock and roll that sparked his interest. But Thomas Brody Sangster, it's odd because, so he's one of those actors who suffers from, and maybe this is just in my eyes, he suffers from being the kid in Love Actually and it being impossible to think of him as anything other than 11 years old. and also still looking like he's 11 years old, despite being like, you know, 80 or however however old he is now.
The literal age of Paul McCartney.
But even when he showed up in what was the chess thing that everyone watched in Netflix? Queen's Gambit.
Yes, that's right.
Like he showed up in that, like playing like a really cocky chess genius character, and kind of couldn't quite buy it, you know.
And I hear what you're saying, because I do think there's a.
I don't think he's a bad actor at all.
But I think that's it, because I do think he's a really good actor.
Yeah,
and I think that what he, because I'd have to look up film dates, but in my mind, his role in this film isn't actually much later than his role in Love Actually. And I can't think of what he would have done in between those two films.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Is this 2009? Love Actually is 2002 or 2003? Something like that,
perhaps,
I think.
Perhaps. We're probably looking at 6-7 years difference, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure he'd been in other stuff before then, and probably really obvious stuff that I'm just forgetting right now. But I do think that he brings a lot to both those roles. Like, even Love Actually. Like, not, I know this isn't a Love Actually, this isn't a Richard Curtis podcast, but like, other than Yesterday. But you know, he is a very, very good actor. I think you're right in the fact that he just suffers from extremely youthful looks, which I think means that we all remember him from those sort of, that older role.
Yeah.
But I think he does a really good job of playing Paul here. And I think he does, what I like about his Paul in this film is that he doesn't get intimidated by John's posturing.
Yeah.
You know, like when they first meet each other and he starts playing and he kind of sees through that sort of intimidation technique that John's trying to put on him. He doesn't sort of stand for it. Well, as in, he doesn't react, but he just sort of doesn't get intimidated by it. And I kind of feel like that's, a nice leeway into how Lennon very quickly establishes some respect for him.
Yeah, as I say, he seems to have chosen a circle of friends that he can dominate.
Yeah.
And then someone comes along who is, frankly, a better musician than him, and he knows it.
Yeah.
And also someone who has his own self-confidence and will kind of stand up to him a bit.
Yeah.
And I suppose he has to make a decision at that point of, like, do I want this guy in the group, which will threaten my dominance of it, or do I want it to be a better group with this guy in it? I think probably made the right choice ultimately.
Possibly, who's to say? Yeah. Only time will tell.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And like a similar point about that is, even though he is not a major character at all, George in this, it is interesting how he meets John and is similarly not intimidated by him. Whereas actually, I think in real life, I get the impression he was a bit more cowed by John being a fair bit older than him and sort of much more dominant.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that was my understanding as well. And I thought that scene played out differently to how I would have imagined.
He's being quite witty. He makes a joke about, oh yeah, I didn't bring my top hat with me or something like that.
Yeah.
But what actually one thing I really enjoyed, seeing an actual filmed depiction of the raunchy on the top deck of a bus anecdote.
Yeah.
Go on, George, get your guitar out, play raunchy.
Yes.
You know, raunchy, note perfect, you're in. You know? Yeah, McCartney, that's right, yeah. The way McCartney tells that in the anthology, I have such a clear mental image of that scene.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that you see it filmed and you realise that actually you already had a mental picture and it's pretty much exactly like it is filmed.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really nice just to see that brought to life in a way.
And but, you know, that's an interesting part about all this as well is we've spoken before on this podcast many times about how historical accuracy isn't necessary in order to tell a good story.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels worth touching upon where in this film it seems to take license a little bit. So one the thing for me is, you know, and I did stumble across this when I was researching the film. One of the things for me that really stood out was John punching Paul McCartney at his mum's funeral. Now, yeah. That feels like a big moment in both their lives.
Right.
Did it happen? The answer is no. I know this because it turns out that Sam Taylor-Wood has talked about showing a screening of this film to Paul McCartney and talking to him about some of the inaccuracies in the film. Some of which include the fact that Mimi wasn't as mean as she is portrayed in the film.
Yeah. Paul and Yoko apparently were very keen, saw early screenings and were very keen to make that point.
Yeah.
That Mimi wasn't that strict. Yeah.
And also, there was also something about how Lennon never sat at the top deck of the bus or something.
Oh, really?
I could be wrong. There was something like that anyway. But it was interesting to me that there were, and also obviously McCartney being punched at the funeral didn't happen. And that, by all accounts, it sounds like Sam Taylor-Wood had to explain to McCartney that she felt it was more important to tell a film than to tell a documentary.
Yeah.
So they had to come to a consensus that, like, reach a compromise around, you know, whether or not this made better sense to serve as a story than it did in real life.
Okay.
And which is the point that we always make on his films.
Yeah,
it does. The funeral thing didn't actually sort of stick out at me though, because I just feel like that's particular license that's been taken, because it feels like a big moment for both those characters, and when you're dealing with two people who are so famous, who have such a history and a well known history, it feels weird to sort of invent a moment between them.
Yeah, it does, and I think also maybe the bits. Before the funeral, so it's John's birthday party where, like, what's the song that is the song that, like, Paul is, like, quietly playing to Julia in the kitchen? It's the one that Stuart Sutcliffe sings in Backbeat. It's the Elvis one.
Love Me Tender.
Yes, Love Me Tender. I think that's it. And she says, oh, that's for your mum, wasn't it? You know, and that is, like, from a narrative point of view, that's there so that John can become more resentful at the idea that his mother is, it gets the impression it's not him who's special, it's just that she enjoys being around.
Yeah.
But like young people in general, it just sort of, you know, it just enjoys that. And so he gets a bit jealous about that. I mean, whether that happened at all. Like, Paul certainly talks about having met Julia, as we said earlier, with the ukulele thing and all the rest of it, you know, and has fond memories of her. But I get the impression that is kind of artistic license as well, the way that's been portrayed.
So here's another interesting point for you.
Yeah.
On the same note, I have a question. In the words of comedian Bill Hicks, I have a question for you. It's a one-word question.
Yeah.
You ready?
Okay.
Incest.
Right.
Now,
for or against?
Now, we should touch on this because I think that this was a some controversy surrounding the film at the time was that there is that Julia's flirtatious nature crossed lines makes it sound like it happened in real life. In the film, it certainly seems to cross lines invokes sort of confused feelings in John with how she behaves around him.
Yeah.
I think is probably the most diplomatic or fairest way of putting it.
Yeah.
Thoughts on whether we feel like that is there's truth to that part of the story at all?
Yeah, it's tricky to know. Cinema actually does not necessarily have a good visual shorthand that can be displayed in a montage or something of a man and a woman getting to know each other and enjoying each other's company. It doesn't have a better shorthand for that than at least the kind of semiotics of a romantic relationship. I don't know whether I've explained that very well, but...
You haven't.
Okay. Was it semiotics?
I'd be lying if I said I was up with you up until that point.
Fine. I think what did you ever see a film called? It's either People Like Us or People Like Us. It's
Chris
Pine, Elizabeth Banks.
Yeah.
So I think he is like her long lost brother.
I remember,
and he turns up in her life, and he doesn't tell her. And they kind of get to know each other, and the way that they get to know each other, there's a sort of montage of like, I can't remember it that well, but let's say, riding horses down the beach together and going on the Dodgems together and
enjoying an ice cream and stroll on the beach promenade and
that kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. So they're brother and sister, but the film needs to show you in a quick and easy way that these are two people who are getting to know each other and are enjoying each other's company. It's not trying to show you anything romantic, but it doesn't really have any other shorthand for that than the general visual grammar of how men and women are usually shown to be getting to know each other, which is through the romantic comedy or the romantic film.
Sure, yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah,
that's what's happening there. Now, that's obviously not exactly what's happening here.
I feel like this is much more overt in this film.
It is much more overt. But if you think about, we were talking about this sort of brief point in John's life where Julia came back into his life and he reestablished a relationship with her before she was killed. If as a filmmaker you are trying to show that this had an effect on him, and particularly with the fact that she, which seems to be true in real life, that she, it was fun, enjoyed dancing, was quite flirty, that kind of thing. And what you need to show the viewer is how intoxicated John was by this. That's probably the way to do it.
So what you're saying is the visual grammar, as you say, in portraying that happening, can easily be misconstrued as something that is more romantic or has more sexuality to it, just because of the nature in which it's being portrayed through film.
Well. I do think that's the case. That isn't necessarily what's going on here. I mean, the fact that it looks like there is a hint of incest going on. A hint of incest.
Oh God!
One of my favorite Agatha Christie novels. A hint of incest. ICV.
Moving on.
The reason that it seems like there's a hint of incest there is because there is. I'm not saying that it's just our interpretation. It's in the film for sure.
Yeah.
And so you have to think, well, what is the justification for this? Because it's quite a big deal. It's not like Sam Taylor Wood is flat out coming out and saying, oh, yeah, there was definite sort of...
John fancied his mum.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But for her to at least hint at it, she needs some basis for it. So like, I went and looked for what evidence she could have taken from this.
Uh-huh.
And so what I came across was Philip Norman's book, John Lennon, The Life, which came out in 2008, which was the year before this film, probably a bit too late for it to actually... influenced this, but I'm sure this quote would have been available before it was published in this book. So there was, it writes a little bit about John becoming aware of a sort of sexual atmosphere between his mother and Twitchy Dykins at the house. Twitchy Dykins, played by David Morrissey in the film.
Mm.
And it says he also became increasingly conscious of Julia's physical allure, the more so as she had always treated him in a jokey, flirtatious manner, more like a sportive young aunt. Sportive's a good word.
Sportive's a great word, yeah.
And
there's lots of layered meanings in that word.
Yeah, yeah. So the short passage here says, one afternoon when he was playing truant from Quarry Bank, as usual, he lay on her bed next to her as she took an afternoon rest. He never forgot what she was wearing. Quote, a black angora short-sleeved, round-necked sweater, not too fluffy. Maybe it was that other stuff. Cashmere. Soft wool, anyway. And, I believe, that tight, dark green and yellow mottled skirt. End quote. As they lay there, he accidentally touched Julia's breast. Quote, and I was wondering if I should do anything else. It was a strange moment because at the time I had the hots, as they say, for a rather lower class female who lived on the opposite side of the road. I always think I should have done it. Presumably she would have allowed it. End quote. So,
right.
The word presumably is really interesting there.
Yes. Yes.
So John Lennon was a screwed up guy, right? And the idea that there is a sort of psychosexual element to him, as far as his relationship with his mother goes, you can't view it with any great surprise, especially because, you know, the fact that he used to call Yoko Ono mother. You know, he was not. He didn't hide particularly the fact that he saw Yoko as a mother substitute in some way.
Yeah,
you know,
let's take that into account as well. He was obviously known for constantly being provocative in what he said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Interviews and stuff.
Yeah, he was quite open about stuff like this.
Yeah.
It's not a lot to base as much on as this film does, mm-hmm. is what I will say.
Mm-hmm.
It is certainly artistic license that Nowhere Boy is taking. But if you think about the way it portrays it, there is a scene in which he lies down on a sofa with her and you can see he feels slightly uncomfortable.
Yeah, which actually was brought to mind as you read that.
Yeah.
You know, that feels like it was influenced almost by that same quote.
Yeah. Other than that, are there bits in the film where it's anything like as overt as that? And I'm not sure. I think it's quite subtle in general.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, definitely. I think it's through, you know, it's through her flirtatious manner.
Yeah.
You know, it's how she behaves around him. And then I think it's reinforced later on when you can see him having pangs of jealousy, which could and should be interpreted as more about his mum giving attention to other guys rather than sexual attention.
Yes.
But because the film has done the groundwork already in offering up this idea, it sort of works in both ways later on in the film when those sort of jealous feelings come through.
Yeah.
Interesting. It's an interesting side of that film. And I think that it's, it was at the time kind of controversial to portray it in that way. But
yeah.
Like you've given, perhaps there was truth in it.
Well, yeah, but also, as we said earlier, this was shown in advance to Paul and Yoko.
Yeah.
And they were, well, who knows? They certainly had an influence over how the film did turn out because they had, as I said, particular strong thoughts about Aunt Mimi not being as strict as she was shown. And I think it was then re-edited to make Mimi a bit softer. Or to show, you know, to highlight the softer side of her a bit more. Who knows? I mean, it's really hard to know whether they would have seen scenes like that and thought, it's rubbish. John didn't fancy his mum. Like, why have you put that in there? You know, as you said earlier, Sam Taylor Wood seems perfectly comfortable to argue her corner against Paul McCartney of all people.
Yeah.
You know, about, like, yes, I know he didn't punch you at his mum's funeral, but you know, artistic license for this reason, you know, is justified. And presumably she would have been, she must have felt strongly that she wanted this to be in there in order to argue that case, if she had to argue that case.
Yeah.
But I presume it would have come up if you'd asked, you know, the guy's childhood friend and his ex-wife, his widow rather, that, you know, would you like to see this film? It strongly implies that he had sexual feelings for his mother.
Mm.
They're probably going to mention it, right?
Yeah, yeah. But also, to take it one step further, not only did that discussion take place, but Yoko Ono, upon seeing this film, then gave the rights for that film to use Mother.
Yeah.
Which plays over the end credits.
Yeah.
So not only was it a sort of a case of convincing her that this was acceptable, I think Yoko was fully on board with the film in general in order to allow it the use of that song.
Yeah.
And what a song. You know, a song that essentially reinforces this whole conversation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Mother, you had me but I never had you. It's pretty on the nose, as it were, in terms of that theme.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Let's move on from the icky subject of incest. the last thing I guess I wanted to chat to you about was just, you know, touching on Mother, the use of music in general. One of the things that I hadn't appreciated when I first saw this film 13 years ago, but obviously now I'm much more sort of well-versed in Beatledom, was the use of Maggie May in the film, which was nice to see a couple of times.
Yeah,
Again, a relatively, not even relatively, but actual factual inaccuracy in the film portrays the Quarrymen playing that song when when Paul McCartney sees them for the first time, and that apparently wasn't the case. It was a different song.
Oh, was it? Okay.
But idea that it being like, you know, obviously I know Maggie May is a traditional Liverpool folk song, and the idea that this was taught to John by his mum and that they ended up taking that through to sort of Quarrymen performance was quite a nice, neat touch, actually, and a nice way to tie into sort of later Beatles music catalogue without actually having to deal with that pesky copywriting again.
Oh, right. I see. I wasn't sure what you meant, but So the thing where when Paul actually came and saw him, like the way he described it, he was playing the Del Viking song, Come and Go With Me.
That's right, yes.
Making up his own words.
But in the film, they're playing Maggie May.
Right, okay, with you. But yeah, to sort of tie it to the, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 it makes sense. Yeah, it's a nice little link. I think the performance of In Spite of All the Danger at the end.
Yes.
The musical performance of it. And also the way it's shot with John singing, or Aaron Taylor Johnson rather, singing it very, very passionately.
Yeah,
it's fantastic, and I'm always struck by that song. How sophisticated it is.
Yeah, I was listening to it a lot today. I'm always listening to this. Yeah,
for a bunch of 16, 17 year olds, especially like. George's little vocal, but the,
yeah, I love that. Yeah, all it's that amazing. Stuff yeah,
is really like agree. Wow. The fact that they came up with that at that age, it's hard to know whether, like, you listen to that now and it's like, well, this is early Beatles, so you know, it sounds better than anything anyone else was doing at that time, or whether it genuinely was a cut above everything else because they were special even then, or it's just because of the fact that, you know, there were a million other recordings like this of groups in Liverpool. It's just that we've never heard them, which were equally good. Who knows?
And also because Paul has always gone on record and saying that they got by stealing from other artists, right? And I think I listen to In Spite of All Danger and think that is a fantastic, fantastically sophisticated song for them for their age.
Mm.
How much of that was originality and inventiveness on their part, and how much was it them copying similar chord changes and breakdowns from other songs that they'd been learning to play at that time?
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer to that, because it sounds like a song of that time.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to determine now whether it was different enough to show their sort of music or their songwriting talent that you know.
Oh, I think it is. I mean, it sounds you know, it sounds quite sort of Buddy Holly-ish, I suppose. Yeah. But I would struggle to think of any specific Buddy Holly song that it has, that it has it's stolen lines or even chords from.
Mm.
Because I know what you mean. There is a thing. There's a at that it changes into a seventh. The you know chord changes to a seventh, which is a thing that like anyone is anyone who's learning guitar, a sort of bluesy guitar is like you know that's you're very familiar with a chord change like that. But all that really is kids who have been listening to rock and roll and blues and understand that that is a thing that happens in it.
Yes, but I think I really like the use of the song in the film. I think that it was it's a nice way to add an extra layer of meaning to that song, which I wouldn't have said previously it was possible to do.
Yeah.
You know, but having this sort of tragic layer added to the song was a really, really nice touch.
Yeah.
If only it wasn't for Paul McCartney upon his screening with Sam Taylor Wood to turn around and say, that's not what the song was about.
Is that right?
Yes, exactly right. And for her to have to explain to him, it is a film, not a documentary. Give me this one, please. You know. So yeah, so you got to argue down that one. I think it's a really nice touch in the film, especially now that we know that song so well. I mean, presumably at the time when the film was released as well, we knew it from Anthology.
But yeah.
Because we know that song so well now, it's nice to sort of have an extra layer added to it through the context of this film.
Yeah.
I have discussed everything that I have to discuss about Nowhere Boy. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that is probably broadly it. We talked about the incest, right? That's in there? Right.
I mean, we could go over it again if you really want to. I know this is why you're in it.
No, I think it's fine.
Okay, cool.
I think I'm all incest. So
you just
about.
Looked at your notes and there's just lots the word incest repeated lots of times
in
the
capital
list.
Letters. Yeah.
maybe some drawings or two. So, if you have enjoyed listening to this podcast, even some of the seeder elements of our discussions, please feel free to give us a like and a review on your podcast listening platforms. Elsewhere, you could find us on the usual social media places at Beatles Films Pod. And otherwise, we will see you next week for another episode. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.